Hi, Deborah.
Hi, Sarah. How are you?
Good. I'm Sarah Posner, and this is The Posner Show. And my guest today is Deborah Hafner. She is the president and co-founder of the Religious Institute. She's also an ordained Unitarian minister and a sexologist and an advocate for sex education and sexual justice. And she's here to talk to me today about the legacy of C. Everett Koop, who died this past Monday. So, Deborah, I was interested in your tweets about Dr. Koop. One of them in particular, you thanked him or acknowledged him for having told the truth about abortion. And for a minute, I did a double take because I think that Koop is known to anti-choice activists as the person who worked with Francis Schaeffer on Whatever Happened to the Human Race, which was a rallying cry really for the anti-choice movement, and he was an ardent foe of abortion. But I think you were talking about a slightly different issue that Dr. Koop got involved in as he was Surgeon General under President Reagan.
Right. So I've had a long career in this field, and I was actually working at a Planned Parenthood in the early 1980s when Koop was doing some of his anti-abortion work. And when he was announced as Surgeon General under the Reagan administration in the early 1980s, or mid 1980s, I certainly was one of those people who took a position against him and why he shouldn't have been confirmed because of that anti-abortion fever. But one of the things he did that I remember very well when I was the director of information and training for the Center for Population Options was that he convened a committee to look at the physical and mental health implications of abortion, intending, I think, to prove that abortion was harmful. And the
Harmful to
myth at the
women.
time, and continues to be a myth somewhat, in the anti-abortion community was that abortion caused grave physical and mental health harm. Those of us who had been working on reproductive choice and indeed had worked in family planning clinics knew that that couldn't possibly be the case because of the numbers of people we knew personally, as well as the number of people we served, who, his primary reaction was relief, not distress. So he, in the Public Health Service, convened a commission, and I don't know the year. But released a report saying, much to my surprise, I found out that there was no mental health or physical harm from abortion. And one of the things that I just loved about him, and I think the country loved about him, is that he was very clear. He would say, and I'm paraphrasing, but he would say something to the effect of, I am the nation's doctor, I am not the nation's preacher. And so he always, and this was true for his work in the AIDS epidemic, he always put the science first. And so when he couldn't prove that abortion was harmful, he stood up and said, there is no harm to the woman.
I thought that there was some controversy about the way he relayed that information because I thought I read somewhere that he was supposed to write a report, but when he found out that, or when he concluded that there was no scientific evidence of harm to women who have abortions, that he decided to write a letter to President Reagan
I'm sorry,
instead of
sticking a
issuing
little
a
louder.
that he decided to write a letter to President Reagan instead of issuing a report. Is that
I
right?
don't know the details. I do know that it was very public. I do remember as an activist, we were all, quite surprised and quite pleased, and we quoted it like crazy. So whether it was a full report or a letter, it was certainly a public statement.
So, as somebody who was involved in that kind of activism at that time, how surprised were you when President Reagan nominated to be not, nominated him to be Attorney General, sorry, Surgeon General? Was it regarded as an attempt to politicize that post because of Koop's role in the anti-abortion movement?
I don't want to be an expert on something, and it was a long time ago. I think As I recall, there was a concern. That certainly was the concern. I'm sure we could find letters that were written by Planned Parenthood Federation and by NARAL and by APHA about why he was not an appropriate candidate. You know, I think we have seen men, and particularly men, of great character who have been appointed to offices and who have surprised us.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if we think about some of the Supreme Court justices who people thought, who ended up, you know, in looking at the facts of the cases, ended up being much stronger supporters. And I think what Surgeon General Coop proved was that he was indeed a scientist. He was indeed a medical professional, and he saw his role as being the nation's doctor. And he used, you know, I think much more important than his role on abortion, though, and I assume we're going to get to this, is his role in the AIDS
right.
epidemic, which was heroic and groundbreaking and surprising. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, the fact that he became one of my heroes in the government is mm-hmm. not what one would have anticipated when we were saying, no, don't elect him. You know, don't appoint
him.
Right,
no, but don't appoint him, right. I do want to get to the AIDS issue in a minute, but I wanted to talk a little bit more about the abortion issue. Because I think that, I mean, after he passed away on Monday, I was reading coverage of him, and there was a fair bit of coverage that is echoing what you're saying, particularly with regards to AIDS and that how he was dependent on the evidence, on the scientific mm-hmm. evidence, as opposed to ideology. But what was interesting to me is that after he passed away, he got a lot of praise from anti-abortion groups who, it seemed, were trying to claim him as one of their mm-hmm. own, when in fact, in many arenas, it seems like they are disregarding what he actually stood for. Yes, he was a foe of abortion. Mm-hmm. He was morally opposed to it.
Mm-hmm.
Yet he refused to make up evidence about this harm.
Mm-hmm.
Yet that is it's such a central part of efforts to legislate against abortion in the states, with the right to know laws.
Mm-hmm.
That have passed in a lot of states require doctors to list to women mm-hmm. these alleged physical and psychological harms to them as a result of having an abortion. And so this flies in the face of what Dr. Coop mm-hmm. did, yet they're claiming that he was a hero to their movement.
Well,
it's sort of ironic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I would guess, you know, if he had been asked in recent years about things that interfered with women's health, that put more women at risk, that increased the amount of time that women went from first trimesters to later trimester abortions because of waiting periods, because of consent, because of, you know, trap laws, because of lack of clinics, et cetera,
mm-hmm.
my guess is he would have been against that. And, you know, I think it's important for those of us in the pro-choice movement. Actually, I think we just read we're not supposed to call ourselves the pro-choice movement anymore. But
that's another issue, right?
those of us who support women's access to abortion services and women's moral agencies to make their own decisions, I think we have to acknowledge that there are people of good faith and good character who oppose abortion on moral grounds. And, you know, and of course, the flip thing is to say, well, then they shouldn't have abortions, right? But, you know, I think abortion is a much more morally complex issue than we have been willing to engage. And
mm-hmm.
what he did was he separated his moral beliefs from his medical beliefs. And, you know, there's no question he was strongly anti-abortion before he became Surgeon General. And I don't really know, to be honest, what he did once he was not, you know, whether he continued to speak out against abortion. But certainly as the leader of the Public Health Service, he was quite clear about what his responsibility was. And goodness knows, in the last, you know, 10 years, we have continued to fight and evermore the idea that science should be driving public health policy. And even mm-hmm. in this administration, on, for example, holding up Plan B access to adolescents, we continue to see that politics trumps medical science. And Surgeon General Coop would have none of that.
Mm-hmm.
I frankly wish we were hearing from the current Surgeon General now about why what the FDA did was wrong. And we're not. In fact, I would bet most of your listeners have no idea who she is or what her name is.
So, and what the FDA did wrong, you're talking specifically with regard to Plan B access for adolescents, for women and girls under 17.
Right, that they decided that Plan B, even though all the medical evidence suggests that Plan B access for teenagers would in fact be positive, without a prescription, have continued to require parental permission.
Mm-hmm. Do you know if Dr. Koop ever discussed emergency contraception at all, or contraception? I mean, was he was not opposed to contraception on moral grounds, as far as
no, you know, not at all. I think he was well in his 80s before we had emergency contraception. So okay. I'm guessing it wasn't part of anything that he talked about. I did just find out, someone told me that he remarried 3 years ago at the age of 93.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
So sexuality was obviously an important part of his life. When I took him to Hollywood, I just reread yesterday the speech that he gave at that meeting, and it was phenomenal, Sarah.
I want you to talk a little bit more about that, how you ended up going to Hollywood with Dr. King.
I know, right. Is that,
And there's a Betty White story in here, too?
Yeah, there's a Golden Girls story. So I was working at the Center for Population Options and from 1985 to 88, and I had worked in the public health service. I did my internship in public health school in the Bureau of Community Health Services, and for a period of time, I actually wrote with a Dr. Carol Garvey the standards for family planning in community health centers. And I did it under a man named Michael Samuels. And Dr. Samuels, who's now a public health professor, Dr. Samuels, during the AIDS epidemic and during Surgeon General Koop's term, ended up as the special assistant in Dr. Koop's office. And what some of your listeners may not know is that Dr. Koop, Congress had mandated that a pamphlet go to every person in America on AIDS. I don't remember the year, 85, 86.
Mm-hmm.
And Koop wrote this pamphlet. And in the pamphlet, he called for sex education beginning as early as the third grade. So I was running a sex sexuality education program for a national organization. That national organization is now called Advocates for Youth, for people who don't know the Center for Population Options. And so I had worked for Mike, and so I picked up the phone and I called him and I said, and he got great public attention for calling for sex education in the third grade in this pamphlet. He presumably, and I don't know if this is apocryphal or real, he had presumably written that pamphlet and sent it out without approval of the White House. And it was very brave. It called for clean needles. It called for better education for men having sex with men. And it called for sex education. So I called Michael and I said, tell me what you meant by the call for sex education beginning in the third grade. I mean, that was really quite unheard of in a public discourse at that time. And what he said to me is, I don't know, Deborah, we need your help figuring that out. So as we started to talk about it, and I did provide some assistance, and my organization provided some assistance, we started to talk about what the organization, I was not the head of it, I was a director, what we could do. And CPO had a program called the Media Project, which was working to integrate messages about sexual responsibility, contraceptive use, into entertainment programming. So when I told him about that, Michael said to me, Koop really wants to meet Hollywood. And I said, oh, we can do that. I know how to do that. So we arranged, a woman named Marcy Kelly, who ran that project at the time, went to the Caucus of Writers and Producers, and we put on an event out in Los Angeles for the writers and producers of entertainment TV. And there were people there from, this is going to date me, from St. Elsewhere, from LA Law, big shows who wanted to do something. And you know, I think for younger people, it's hard to remember. I'm sure you do, but the urgency around the AIDS epidemic. I mean, we had, you know, the amount of fear and the death we were surrounded with was just mm-hmm. astronomical. And the fear was that AIDS was going to move into the general population actually quicker than it did. And so he came and I was his escort. And so Michael Samuels and Marcy Kelly and Dr. Koop and I spent a day, and it included, we had breakfast with Morgan Fairchild, who is very prominent actress. I don't know what she's doing now. Mm-hmm. And then we had lunch with Patty Duke Austin, and I had watched Patty Duke as a kid every day after high school. So, you know, that was a huge thing for me.
Identical Cousins, was that the show?
What'd you say?
Identical Cousins.
Right, wasn't right. I could show? Sing you the song, but I won't. And so yep. We had lunch with her, and then he did this incredible speech, which, you know, I don't know how we could get a copy of it posted, but it was, I read it I'll yesterday, and it could be given now, you know, and he talked about how sexuality was wonderful, and how sexual behaviors don't have to include intercourse, and he called for clean needles, and he called for us to have a different attitude about making sure that everyone was safe and everyone was included, whether we agreed with their behaviors or not. I mean, it was stunning. And I have to say, and I was a young 32-year-old at the time, so I was just gaga, you know, the whole day meeting these folks. But he was gaga. And what was so fun about it was that Hollywood was thrilled to meet him, mm-hmm. and he was thrilled to meet Hollywood. So what happened that night was we came on a Friday, and apparently, at least at that time, TV programs taped on Friday nights in front of sitcoms in front of live audiences. And so he was asked what was his favorite program, and his favorite program was The Golden Girls. So we went to a taping of The Golden Girls and got to watch, sit in the audience. And at the end of it, after everyone had left, we were invited onto the set of The Golden Girls, and we spent about 45 minutes with Dr. Koop and Betty White and Bea Arthur and Rue McClanahan and Estelle Getty, talking about the AIDS epidemic and what they could do and what kind of leadership and how they would integrate it into one of their scripts. So I have a great picture that I put on Facebook of me hanging out on the set of The Golden Girls with Surgeon General Koop. Somebody yesterday, when I posted it yesterday, and they said, was I sure I hadn't photoshopped it? Because what was Deborah Hafner, Surgeon General Koop, and The Golden Girls all doing in the same picture? Which I thought was really funny. The end of that story, which is also amusing, is the next day, Variety, the Hollywood paper, covered his trip on the front page. You know, Surgeon General Koop comes to Hollywood, and it said, and he ended his day with his very young wife on the set of The Golden Girls. Which I felt really bad about. I think he'd been married for 45 years to the same woman. You know, who's probably 65 or 70 at this
point. Oh, Variety could use a little fact checking, right?
Right. Right. So for a day, I got to be Dr. Koop's very young wife.
So it wasn't just with regard to the sex education end of mm-hmm. things. He was also instrumental in pushing for approval of drugs to treat AIDS.
I'm sorry,
right?
Again, just a little louder.
He was also involved. So at the time, the Reagan administration was dragging its heels on approving drugs to treat mm-hmm. AIDS. And for anyone who saw the Oscar-nominated movie documentary, How to Survive a Plague, mm-hmm. That was pretty much documented in mm-hmm. that movie, how the Reagan administration was dragging its heels and the role of ACT UP in
right.
pushing the administration to approve drugs. What was Koop's role in all of that? Because I think that he was one person within the administration who did see the need for quicker approval.
Yeah, you know, he spoke up on all of the things that needed to be done. So, you know, he managed to get the CDC more involved. It's hard to believe, but as I recall, I don't think President Reagan ever actually even said the word AIDS. There was a real sense of denial, and Bill Bennett was running the Department of Education, and he was actually actively fighting AIDS education at the time. So although I don't specifically know what specifically he said in terms of drug renewal, I do know that he was talking about clean needles, which is, you know, still controversial. Whoa, these many years later. He was talking about the need for treatment as well as the need for primary prevention. And he was, you know, hotly criticized. And the fact that, you know, I think there is an irony, though, he kept his job. You know, he the Reagan administration did not stop him. I think when Rock Hudson died, that was probably helpful in terms of Reagan stopping working against AIDS. You know, I mean, actively working against things. There was a sense that people were more vulnerable, that people knew were having this disease. So that was definitely a teachable moment. But the reason I think, if you were interviewing my colleagues who were part of and friends who were part of ACT UP, who were part of the AIDS movement in the mid-80s, they were, again, remarkably surprised by the role that he took, you know, that he was willing to stand up and speak out in a way from a science-based perspective and what we really needed. And he was very clear that the idea that we were losing a whole generation of young men was a tragedy, and he would do what he had to keep that from happening.
So on the sex education front, what was his legacy exactly? I mean, did he leave a mark on
it was
sex education
huge.
In America?
I took over CIGAS the following year. So we brought him, I brought him to Hollywood in September of 87, and I was the president of the Sex Information Education Council in 1988. So only a few months later. And in fact, CIGAS was really having a difficult time at that point. And I remember saying to the board of the search committee, if we cannot make CIGAS a bigger, more important organization, a more influential organization, given the call for sex education from the Public Health Service, you know, then it was time for this organization to go to bed. And I thought we were at a Kairos moment, a moment, you know, of real change. By the end of 1989, every state in the country had had passed AIDS education legislation. Every state in the country. It took about a year and a half. And I completely credit Surgeon General Koop with that. I mean, it was, you know, there was three states that had sex education, but all 50 states had an AIDS education program in place. So the urgency, the dialogue about it, the discussion about it, the understanding that AIDS was going to not just affect men who had sex with men, but was increasingly affecting, and he actually, in this speech that I'm referring to, he talked about its disproportionate impact on the Hispanic and Latino communities, the need for looking at, and what was interesting in his speech, it was only in 1987 that we really began to understand that AIDS was being spread by heterosexual intercourse. And so he changed the dialogue. And I think that trip to Hollywood changed the Hollywood dialogue. We really began to see that everyday programs. I was just thinking this morning, I don't know if you got, did you watch The Makers last night?
I didn't get a chance to, no.
So it was a really interesting program that I recommend to you and your viewers, although, you know, there's a lot we could quibble about and things I wish they had done. But they covered the gold. They had a little bit on women in TV and designing women back in, I don't remember, 1990, maybe 1991.
Right, right.
Did an amazing program on AIDS education. And I can remember there were a number of other programs. And I think that he changed the America's understanding that AIDS was about everybody. And up until his bravery, AIDS was considered among the general population something that only happened to them. And he was very clear that this was a disease that we all had to be concerned about. And, you know, it's hard for young people today. I have a 19-year-old son. It's hard for young people today to understand that, you know, kids with AIDS were thrown out of school and people with AIDS were burned and people wouldn't sit next to people with AIDS. And, I mean, the level of discrimination and hate that happened, and he made a difference on that. And, you know, I really view him and my little brush with him as one of the highlights of my almost 35-year career.
So did his discussions of sex education have any impact on sex education beyond AIDS education? I mean, because I think now people tend to think Republicans, abstinence education, opposition to comprehensive sex education. Did he have any role
when states passed these AIDS education mandates, they began to talk about sex in the classroom. I mean, you know, you couldn't do AIDS education without addressing sexual transmission. So we began to see some states really look at what was being offered. Now, there was a counterbalancing moment, which was it was in 1991 and 1992 that the first significant federal monies became available for what I at CECAS labeled fear-based education. The whole abstinence only until marriage stuff did not rise out of nowhere in 1997 with TAMF, but actually was beginning to really have an impact in the early 1990s. And so the pushback on AIDS education became a pushback to sexuality education. And we saw programs like Sex Respect, which taught pet your dog, not your date. We saw there was a movie that was circulating in the early 1990s that held a revolver into the camera, and it said, using a condom to prevent AIDS is like playing Russian roulette. Sooner or later, everyone will die. He did not have the impact, long-term impact. We're still fighting what the content of sex education in the schools should be. People like myself, actually, I have come in recent years to believe that we basically should give up on the schools as a place where kids are going to get information about things like homosexuality and pleasure and real prevention information, that we need to be looking more towards the churches and the synagogues where values education is okay. We need to be looking more towards the internet as a place where young people can get honest information. I think what I used to say at CECAS is that on sex education, we won the war, which is everyone agrees the school should cover issues like puberty and family roles and responsibility and taking good care of your body and treating people with respect. And that's not controversial. The areas that are controversial, homosexuality, abortion, contraception, masturbation, they were controversial when I started in this field. And unfortunately, in 2013, they're controversial still.
Right, right. Well, maybe we can talk about all of that in another
episode. Great. I'd love that.
So thank you so much for sharing, especially the Hollywood story about Dr. King.
I know. So fun, right?
And I think that will be in your memoir someday. But before you write your memoir, I think you have a new book out on another topic. Is that right?
I do. I've just published this little book called Meditations on the Good News, Reading the Bible for Today. And it's a new book designed to help people who have actually rejected the Bible or think it's irrelevant see that there is wisdom in the Bible for all of us, whether you are a literalist or whether you are somebody who thinks, why do people still read this book? So I took 40 passages that talk about why the Bible teaches us to lead a joyful, enriched, fulfilling life that countered the idea that the Bible only teaches us that life is sinful. I hope that it's a way for people who have not been interested in the Bible to maybe find their way in.
Okay. Well, listen, thanks so much for doing this today.
Thank you. Thank you for all you do, Sarah.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.